might look like a psychedelic-looking attraction that you'd expect to find at Disneyland. The Wat Sam Phan, or Dragon Temple, is located 40 kilometers west of Bangkok, Thailand, rarely featured in guidebooks, and is enclosed by a giant dragon wrapped around the structure with its head rising up above the roof. And if you visit this Buddhist temple, you'll probably see many women dressed in white as they meditate and perform various ceremonies to gain spiritual strength, physical vitality, and emotional encouragement from the mystical dragon. Okay, so exactly who or what is behind the 17-story mythical serpent with the alleged ability to heal? The Ouroboros is an ancient symbol depicting a serpent or dragon eating its own tail, a symbol of cyclical time, a continual renewal of life, death, and rebirth, leading to immortality or enlightenment. It's a widespread symbol of the all-in-all, the totality of existence, infinity, and the cyclical nature of the cosmos. In pre-Columbian Central America, Quetzalcoatl was sometimes depicted as biting its own tail. The mother of Quetzalcoatl was the Aztec goddess Quetzalcoatl, the Lady of the Serpent. Quetzalcoatl's father was Mixcoatl, or Cloud Serpent. He was identified with the Milky Way, the stars, and the heavens in several Mesoamerican cultures. Some ancient texts refer to the Serpent of Light residing in the heavens, a light which also surrounds the earth, as well as all living beings such as people, a universal energy force, but not quite electricity or magnetism. In Gnosticism, the serpent symbolized eternity of the soul. The image of the serpent as an embodiment of wisdom transmitted by Sophia was an emblem especially used by those sects that are Ophites, or serpent people. The serpent was one of the earth animals associated with the cult of Mithras, as well as the Magi. In Hinduism, Kundalini is a coiled serpent, the residual power of pure desire. Kundalini refers to the energy of yogic awakening, leading to altered or higher states of consciousness. The symbol of snakes coiled around a staff is an ancient representation of Kundalini, where the staff represents the spinal column and the snake being energy channels. In the case of the two coiled snakes, they usually cross each other 7 times, and that's a possible reference to the 7 energy centers known as chakras. In some Abrahamic traditions, the serpent represents sexual desire. The noble wing symbol of the Zoroastrianism, found etched in stone across the Middle East, enduring for millennia, also embodies the symbolic element of immortal spirit. The circle, however, is in the center here, and it's reminiscent of a hula hoop. The sacred winged symbol seems to have a counterpart in China called the vermilion bird, representing the fire element similar to the phoenix, symbolic of rebirth and resurrection in Western mythologies. The vermilion is described as a red bird, resembles a pheasant, has 5 colored plumage, perpetually covered in flames, and is associated with the Chinese empress, as the dragon is associated with the emperor. In Greek mythology, a phoenix is associated with the sun, symbolizing renewal and resurrection, attributes also reflected in the Native American thunderbird and the Russian firebird. Simurgh is a benevolent mythical bird in Iranian mythology and literature, also equated with the phoenix, and translated from Farsi means 30 chickens. And from the Persian poetry, the context is size. This creature is the size of 30 chickens in the myths. It's also interesting that in Armenia, it resembles the word siramarg, which means peacock, where the description in other cultures are mythological and sound at least exaggerated. Here we come across a living example that's also revered by the Yazidi tribe, whose ancient relationship with the peacock traces back to Sumerian times and the dawn of recorded history. And it could very well be that the peacock is the mysterious bird that the myths are based on, especially since it shows up frequently in art and religious symbolism going back over 5,000 years. So when we watch this magnificent bird in slow motion fly with its long, colorful serpentine tail, one can see how a case can be made for this bird somehow being divine or associated with a solar religion. When open, its tail just looks like rays of the sun. Zoroastrian scriptures, the Avesta, state that the bird was originally a raptor, like an eagle, falcon, or sparrowhawk. Sanskrit texts also agree that it was a type of raptor, which means it was a bird of prey. So that raises some doubts for me about the exotic-looking peacock. What exactly is a raptor?
A raptor is a category of bird. There are many types of raptors, and there are many species of raptors. Let's start with Sandy Gibbs. Sandy is one of our volunteers, and she is holding a red-tailed hawk. And the red-tailed hawk is one that you will often see. It is named for the reddish-colored tail feathers that it has here, and it has these feathers as an adult. When it is a juvenile bird, it has a brown striped tail. They come in lots of different colors and even lots of different sizes. But if you see a large, conspicuously perched hawk, it's probably a red tail. These birds are very large. They look a lot bigger when they're flying. They can sometimes have over a 4-foot wingspan. They are great, meaning large, and horned because they have these feather tufts on their heads, which are not actually horns or ears. They are just feathers that perhaps help camouflage the bird. Now, these birds are incredibly strong, stronger even than the red-tailed hawk we just saw. His prey is pretty much what the red-tailed hawk eats during the day. He eats at night. So rabbits, rats, any number of ground-dwelling mammals, and also anything he can catch. These great horned owls are actually capable of carrying more than half their weight, but still these birds are lighter than they look. This bird weighs less than 5 pounds, which means that he would labor to carry something that weighs 3 pounds. He can kill large things, but he would still labor to carry it off. This species of vulture is called a black vulture. Lots of people call these birds buzzards, and buzzard is a slang term. It's okay to use it, but they're more properly called vultures. These birds are very gregarious. They eat together. The different species hang out together. They will also search for prey together. They eat dead animals. They are scavengers. And scavengers like this are responsible for cleaning up all the roadkill and all the animals that die of other causes in the woods and along the waterways. They prevent the spread of disease by ingesting all of the dead, rotten material from the carcasses of a variety of creature, whether it's a dog or a deer, another bird. These birds consume all that material and they render it harmless with their strong digestive systems. Now, our next bird here that Carrie has is an eastern screech owl. Often people enjoy watching these little birds because they're kind of cute to some people, but they do make quite a mess. Now, you need to be careful whenever you handle a bird that it's got very sharp talons and a very sharp hooked beak, so I don't recommend grabbing them. I recommend spooking them away. But if they appear sick or tame, it's not necessarily the case. They often just sit very still and allow themselves to be approached very quickly and without spooking away as you would expect. Doesn't mean they're sick. Now, these birds live all over the place. They come in different colors. This is their full size. And they also do a great job keeping your yard clear of insects and mice.
It's said that the ancient Greeks called the Canaanites Phoenician after the word phoenix, because it means purple or crimson, a color famously used as a dye. That said, there's another definition which may apply here. Phoenix is a genus of 14 species of palms, native to an area starting from the Canary Islands in the west, across North and Central Africa, to the extreme southeast of Europe, like Crete, and continuing throughout Southern Asia, from Turkey east to Southern China and Malaysia. When we look at this Egyptian clay tablet, we see that the tree of life is portrayed as a date palm, considered the tree of abundance to the Assyrians. associated with fertility and plenty. Hathor was known as Lady of the Date Palm. She is also associated with the sycamore or fig tree. The ancient Egyptian word for date and sweet are the same. According to Herodotus, and I quote, "The date palm meets all the other needs of the population. They make from it a kind of bread, wine, vinegar, honey, cakes. The smiths use the stones of its fruit for charcoal. These same stones, broken and macerated, are given as a fattening food to cattle and sheep." End quote. It has a very sweet fruit, which can be made into alcohol, and was prized for its sweetness, along with figs. And the tree was usually pollinated by hand. Mutualism is the way two organisms of different species exist in a symbiotic relationship in which each individual benefits from the activity of the other. And in the case of the fig tree and wasp, neither can survive without each other. There are more than 700 species of fig, and each one has its own species of wasp. Figs are technically inverted flowers, and they store their pollen on the inside of the fruits, and they can be found year-round. In order to pollinate the female fruits, the wasp enters to lay its eggs. After hatching, the young wasps mate, and the males, who are born with sharp teeth but without wings, chew holes through the fig skin for the winged females to escape. After that, the males die. The females, pregnant, loaded with pollen, fly to other fig trees, crawl into the fruit to lay their eggs, beginning the cycle anew. Now, when the female wasp slides in through the narrow passage of the fig, her wings are ripped off. So the egg laying is a one-way mission, and while she's unsuccessful in laying her eggs, she successfully pollinates the female flower. So the now flightless wasp is trapped inside the ripening fruit, where it's digested by special enzymes within the fig. And according to fossil records, this process has been going on virtually unchanged for 34 million years. Buddha found enlightenment under a fig tree. And that's what these bags are for. They contain pollen, and what's being depicted here is a symbolic blessing in front of the sacred tree, with the king dipping into the bag of pollen and symbolically pollinating his kingdom himself. Beekeeper was the title given to the pharaoh, and honey was an offering presented to the gods in the afterlife. So the bag was part of a symbolic blessing scene involving pollen. It also suggested that the Assyrian kings and their helpers, sometimes called angels, were emulating bees, which in effect made them bee gods. Bees appeared on statues of goddess Artemis, whose priests were called Essenes or King Bees, and Ephesus, the city where her most famous bee-laden statues hail from, had a Bronze Age name that translated as bee. Another account of the bee in Mesopotamian mythology relates to Inanna, the Sumerian goddess of love and war, who appears as early as 4000 BC, and she was the goddess of Venus, the morning and evening star, and as a result, she's associated with dualities such as love and war. And the primary religious figure for the Minoans of Crete was the mother goddess. She had numerous manifestations, one of which was the bee. The queen bee was especially important, for she was the leader and ruler of the hive, seven Mesopotamian antediluvian demigods, semi-divine beings that attend to the tree of life. And so for Sumerians, these are bird-like winged deities that were tending to the tree. The pine cone was dipped in the pollen bag, a tribute perhaps to both the pine cone's immortality symbolism and its role as an icon of enlightenment. The tree, because of its evergreen foliage, has been traditionally considered an emblem of longevity and vitality. According to Encyclopedia Britannica, the tree of knowledge and the tree of life are both forms of the world tree or cosmic tree, Yggdrasil in Norse mythology. Now let's take a look at this sign. Among early Christians, it was known as the Manus Obscena or obscene hands. The fig sign is a gesture made with the hand and fingers curled and the thumb thrust between the middle and index fingers, or rarely the middle finger and ring fingers, forming a fist so that the thumb partly pokes out. In ancient Greece, this gesture was a fertility and good luck charm, and it's for warding off evil, like the Hamza. So if you look at this image from the American Sign Language, T is the fig sign. The hand gesture may have originated in ancient Hindi culture to depict the lingam or yoni. In Italy, the sign is known as mano in fica, or the fig hand, or farla fica, excuse the language, the cunt gesture, for the resemblance to the female genitalia. In Greece, and particularly in Ionian islands, this gesture is still used, known as the fist phallus. In Japan, this sign is called sekusu and means sex. So it's interesting that it's used here in the Sumerian context with the sacred tree. Algiz, also called Elhaz, is a powerful rune because it represents the divine might of the universe. It's a rune of higher vibrations, the divine plan, and higher spiritual awareness. The symbolism of the raptor, or bird of prey, in regards to the ancient myths and traditions, starts with the sky burial, where the deceased is symbolically meant to unite with the sky god, or sacred realm, by first being placed on a burial tree, or something similar, used for supporting corpses, such as a Tower of Silence, as it is called in Zoroastrianism, a circular, raised structure built for dead bodies to be exposed to scavenging birds, who consume the remains and fly up to the heavens. Evidence of such practices can be found in places like Stonehenge and even Göbekli Tepe over 11,000 years ago, with much of the exact same serpent symbolism etched on massive stone T's, the shape of the fig sign, if you remember, complete with pollen bags. And in this case, the birds of prey seem to be vultures. Göbekli Tepe even has its own Ouroboros, with similar looking vultures being used in Tibet. The Tibetan Book of the Dead describes this very well. However, Tibet is above the tree line, so trees were not used. According to Herodotus, the rites are said to have been secret, performed after the body had been dragged around by a dog. In the Iranian Zoroastrian tradition, the towers were built atop of hills or low mountains, but they gradually discontinued their use and began to favor cremation. And this gives a possible link to the symbolic relation of the phoenix to fire, the phoenix bird or the phoenix tree, either one. Forbidden fruit is a phrase that originates from Genesis concerning Adam and Eve. And in the narrative, Adam and Eve ate the fruit of good and evil in the Garden of Eden, which they had been commanded not to do so by God. So which fruit was this on the tree? According to some versions of the Bible, it was an apple. And we hear of Adam's apple from the notion that it was caused by the forbidden fruit sticking in Adam's throat as he swallowed. The Talmud says grapes, and it could refer to grapes being made into wine, for example, like alcohol. Pomegranate is another choice, where proponents of the Middle Eastern Garden of Eden associate the pomegranate with knowledge of the underworld as provided by the ancient Greek legend of Persephone. In Islam, the Quran mentions that pomegranates grow in the Garden of Paradise, and in Hinduism, Persian, and in Chinese culture, the pomegranate is also considered a symbol of fertility and procreation associated with the earth goddess. Today, the pomegranate still has strong symbolic significance for the Greeks. At important festivals, including Christmas, it's customary to adorn the table with pomegranates, known as polysporia, meaning many-seeded. Wheat, although commonly confused with a seed, in the study of botany, a wheat berry is technically a simple fruit known as a caryopsis, which is similar to an apple. Just as an apple is a fleshy fruit that contains seeds, a grain is a dry fruit that absorbs water and contains seeds. In Hebrew, wheat is kitah, which has been considered to be a pun on ket, meaning sin. Mushrooms are another common suggestion we hear about. The late Terence McKenna proposed that the forbidden fruit was a reference to a psychotropic plant and fungi, or mushrooms, specifically psilocybin mushrooms. Another option is the fig, as it was from fig leaves that the garments for Adam and Eve were made. So which do you think it is? What was the forbidden fruit on the tree?
Let us assume for a moment that we are seeking to discover the axis or the central theme of the Atlantean culture. What was the great religious symbol among the Atlanteans? To them, the serpent was the symbol of God. Irish people claim that the first teachers of their race came not from the east, from Europe, but from the west. And that ancient robed priests came out of the ocean on the west coast of Ireland. And that these were the ones who instructed them. The Irish have a considerable folklore dealing with Atlantis. There is also a great deal of lore relating to this in the Spanish area and in Portugal. And of course, what is left of North Africa bears testimony to the same basic accounts. The symbols always of the ancient initiate kings, the symbols of the secret masters of magic in ancient times. And it is believed that by this, the Druids, who received it also, and used it twisted as a serpent symbol around the Orphic egg, that among these ancient peoples, this symbol had to do with the magnetic field of the earth. To them, the serpent was the symbol of pure life. To them, it was also the symbol of energy and of power. And the control of power and the directing of energy seems to have had something to do with the rising wisdom of the old Atlantean savants or priests. And several of the early Phoenician historians and Roman historians were convinced the Egyptians were the Atlanteans who could not go home because of the destruction of their land after their invasion of Athens, or attempt to invade Athens. The royal symbol of the Egyptians was the serpent coiled upon the forehead of the solar crown. And in the crowning of the Egyptian pharaoh, the crown of the north and south, was always adorned by a coiled serpent placed directly in the center of the forehead above the nose. This symbol also comes to us from the great serpent balustrades of Angkor Wat. And on the Angkor Wat symbols and in many other parts of India, including the serpent of eternal time upon which Vishnu sleeps in the ancient Vishnu Puranic literature. We always have a serpent with seven heads. Plato tells us that the Atlantic continent was composed of seven principal islands, over which ruled seven princes. We've already learned of the seven heads of Ravan, king of Lanka, the Indian Atlantis. We have also constant reference to this peculiar septenary, the septenary of creating gods at the dawn of things. And we have the seven-headed Naga. We have the mysterious symbol, which many have firm conviction must have originally represented deity in the ancient Atlantean rites. We also know that this serpent appears wherever we have the motion of the so-called Atlantean or Mongolian culture. We have the mysterious serpents of Gobi. We have the serpent in the symbolism of Tibet and China. We have the serpent gradually metamorphosed into the five-clawed dragon, the imperial symbol of China. We know that the dragon lore and the dragon symbol came more and more to be associated with the magician and the sorcerer. We also have the mysterious serpents of Latin America. Quetzalcoatl, the feathered serpent, was a good deity, not an evil one. And we have it among the Zunis and the Hopis, and even among the Navajo peoples. These symbolisms of the serpent we have generally associated with the serpent of evil, but even in the Bible, we are told, be wise as serpents and as harmless as doves. Every one of these groups of myths tell essentially the same origin story, that the peoples came from elsewhere, that they came with leaders who had led them from some previous location, that these leaders were responsible for the establishment of higher orders of culture in primitive areas. Thus, the natural or aboriginal peoples of these areas all insist that their cultures began with the advent of divine beings who came from remote places, from a long distance, from other lands. These remote beings did not resemble the people to whom they came. They wore different clothing. They spoke a different language. But in each case, they brought ideas. And from these ideas, the cultures of these local groups derived their impulse and their inspiration. There are evidences of the survival of Atlantean peoples, vestiges of peoples who have, for one reason or another, remained completely separate, have held on to their traditions, have regarded themselves as dedicated to a sacred destiny, and therefore regarding themselves also with a strange, deep, unchanging pride, a hauteur about themselves, the sense of being a chosen people, a people intended for some strange work of preserving, without loss, an ancient tradition. This chosen concept certainly moves the Ayas from Northern Asia, for the word Aya means the chosen, or the selected, or the set apart ones. But actually, we have much to support the belief that at a remote time, the progenitors of the Aryans, the Ayas as we know them, moved downward from the Trans-Himalayas, across the great Indo-Gangetic Plain, through the great channels cut by the Indus, the Ganges, and the Jumna. And down these great plains moved a wandering nomadic people. This people was ultimately to conquer the world. This people was to supply the races with which we are most commonly concerned today. From the early part of these migrations came the great Aya Hindu race. From it also came the Persian, the Iranian. From it came the Greek and Latin. Also the Celtic, the Anglo-Saxon, the Teuton, and finally the polyglot, which we call the American. These peoples all belong to this great Arya migration. This migration, moving downward from Central Asia, did not move into an uninhabited world. When these peoples met the original inhabitants of India, they came upon the Dravidians, a very ancient stock. And here in the world today, we also have ancient and mysterious stock, such as, for instance, the Basques and other culture groups, which cannot be traced directly, either by racial structure or by language, to any of the dominant cultures that we know today. These strange towers that look almost like Egyptian obelisks, except that they are circular. These towers belong to a kind of architecture, which today is tied into the most elaborate folklore and legendary among a people who have become synonymous with folklore and legendary. The builders of the round towers of Ireland might have been Buddhist monks. For there is a record that Buddhist monks from Asia reached Ireland at a remote period. Asiatic migrants reached Ireland at a very ancient time. How long ago? We do not know. And as we mentioned earlier, the various schools of archaeology are in no common accord as to the primitive remains in Ireland and in the north of Scotland. The Druids at that time used Stonehenge because they regarded it as a monument created by the gods of previous ages.
While Gautama Buddha lived 2,500 years ago, allegedly reaching an enlightened state of spiritual awareness, or nirvana, nothing he said or did was really new, and this includes any symbolism associated with them. He was born an Aryan with blue eyes. His philosophy was well established for thousands of years by his family since the Pleistocene, knowledge passed down through secret initiation since the Ice Age, spiritual teachings practiced by the noble caste of every agricultural civilization, and at his time called the Aryan Path. He understood the occult meaning of the swastika, the serpent, and other ancient revered symbols that are now largely dismissed as superstition. Buddha regarded as a divine force of nature, which is subtly hidden at the heart of the inner mysteries of every major world religion. The original philosophy dealt with harnessing this natural and abundant energy, known to the Chinese as qi and prana to the Hindus. The Kabbalists and Freemasons call this universal energy light, learning to transmute their sexual energy into a creative force that can then be directed. Albert Pike, 33rd degree Freemason, said, and I quote, "There is in nature one most potent force, by means whereof a single man who could possess himself of it and should know how to direct it could revolutionize and change the face of the world," end quote. Helena Blavatsky, foundress of the Theosophical Society, described this as vril energy and as an ether stream that could be transformed into a physical force. William Reich described orgone as the basic building block of all organic and inorganic matter, an energy closely associated with sexuality. The term itself shares the root with the word orgasm. And this was seen as a massless, omnipresent substance similar to ether. Nikola Tesla, considered a genius in the field of energy, is sometimes ridiculed for his lack of sexual relationships. Some people speculate that Tesla was impotent and simply didn't have the urge towards sex, but I don't think that's the case. I believe that Tesla channeled his sexual urges and redirected the life-creating energy into not only gaining spiritual insights, but enhancing his scientific understanding of how this universal energy can be applied on an even grander scale. In other words, Tesla was working on activating the Kundalini energy for the entire planet, as below, so above, a struggle that has been carried forward and still continues in secret today. I'd like to thank my subscribers who have recently made a tax-deductible donation to Atlantean Gardens, the nonprofit organization that sponsors my research and publishes my books. My name is Robert Sepper. I'm an independent anthropologist, producer, and author that is very grateful for your recent generosity, and all the donations that came in are making a big difference here. So I thank you wholeheartedly. Please also consider taking a look at my books available on Amazon.com. Please subscribe if you haven't already. Kindly share these videos if you find them interesting. So will your friends and family. I appreciate your feedback, your comments, especially when they're positive or constructive. And as always, Buffy says hello and thanks you for the support. My name is Robert Sepper. I look forward to seeing you next time.